somebody asked if we're going to have a syllabus. I think when the Book of Mormon is thoroughly studied, which it may be in years to come, it will be agreed that it's the most perfect book ever written in structure, in form, everything, exactly what the message meant to convey. This chapter we're looking at today, this sixth chapter, is miraculous in its structure, in its simplicity, in its directness. So why would we need a syllabus? I think it's an impertinence to ask for a syllabus when we have the supreme syllabus in the Book of Mormon. It is a syllabus. It's such, remember, this is the syllabus of hundreds of records, of hundreds of volumes. We're told that, you see. So this is the syllabus, and this is the one we pay attention to. And so, since I don't have the role today and can't ask questions, that's a horrible thing. Let's talk about, then, the style of the Book of Mormon. If you notice, start out here. I should ask somebody a question here, but what do you notice in the first two verses? What do they have in common? What peculiar stylistic use do you find in the opening sentences of these two verses? It came to pass. You immediately realize that the Book of Mormon is formulaic, that the ancients wrote in formulas, just as we do today. We don't write in separate individual words. We think and speak in form, but the ancients did it much more than we did. If a thing has been perfectly and well said, you can do no better than to quote it. And so if you look down in the margins of your Book of Mormon at the bottom, or if you look in the margins of the scripture, if you look at your Apparatus Criticus, you'll find all that any scripture is a lot of quotes from other scriptures. Everybody's quoting everybody else all the time. And that's so with ancient literature too. There was no copyright then. You were free to use anything, and you should be. This copywriting and the stealing of ideas is utterly absurd. As Upton Sinclair used to say, the purpose of a person with ideas is to have them stolen. You're not supposed to keep an idea to yourself. The same thing with an invention. You get your pay, that's all right. This nonsense about royalties and stuff like that. We'll turn that all back to farms. So, first this idea of story, it came to pass. Now, this is one of the critical points. The Book of Mormon has been criticized for it came to pass, it came to pass. Mark Twain said, if you leave out all that came to passes, the Book of Mormon would be a pamphlet. Do you have to have these things? Well, you certainly do. It helps the Book of Mormon and everything else. It was Nilsson, Martin P. Nilsson, the great Swedish scholar, who calls that the epic technique. When you're reciting and when you're reading a long passage, you have to take a breath once in a while. You have to lubricate the wheels. You can't face a person every sentence with a brand new statement, a brand new idea, starting cold. You must put padding between the sentences. And in Semitic languages, it's absolutely required to make it easier. See, a third of all the lines in the Odyssey, for example, we quoted that last time, are repeated lines. You repeat. You take a break. You take a breath. And you keep going. This keeps things going. It also keeps the reader's attention. It doesn't drag. For example, I picked up this morning a very old writing. It's from the Middle Kingdom. It's from the time of Seti II, from the 13th century BC. It's a famous story. It comes nearest to the writings of the Patriarchs. It's like the patriarchal romance. It's very closely related to the Bible, very much like Genesis, as the story of Joseph and other things like that in this Egyptian. I say it goes back to the time of Seti II. And what do I find here? It starts out, I've marked in red, I filled in red here, this expression, Yirhirum het heru keni. Now it came to pass after many days. It sounds very Book of Mormonish to me, doesn't it? After many days of all things, that's a usage we don't find in the Old Testament. The Egyptians, remember, Egyptians are fond of it. Book of Mormon is supposed to be written in the language of the Egyptians and the learning of the Jews. So, and then I get down to the next sentence, and it says, Ker yer imhet, yes, inhet tahed, and the second, the sowing. Now it came to pass that after it dawned on the second day, there came to pass, there happened, something happens there. Well, here you actually means, now, next in our story, now, as to what comes next. But the actual expression that came to pass, that's this one here. And you'll see, this is the one they go crazy about. Every sentence in this long story begins with either the head, or a behold, or it came to pass. It's required, you see. So this one starts out here. Carrier, Hereford Terry in Seco. And it came to pass when the time of plowing had come, the Seco, came to pass when the time of harmic come, and then we get a real came to pass, which is this expression, when yin. Now that really means it came to pass. So this starts, it came to, the other is an expression that keeps things going, but here's this Harrier again, Harrier him hit. Now it happened after the next day, the next day dawned, there came so-and-so, and then here it is again. Harrier him hit, Heru, Kenu. It came to pass after many days, there we are again. It goes on of these things. Then, later. And then we get a Wen Yin again. And this, it came to pass that he said to his brother, then it came to pass. Now the next one, the next page, there's nothing but it came to pass. Notice every sentence, there it comes. It came to pass. It came to pass. So notice they're written in here, you can fill them in with red because, well, this is a Stahlabdruck, a copy, and they, where it's written in red, in rubrics. See, in Egyptian, you write in two dimensions, because you have to have depth. You have to have a stereo effect. Everything that is inspired and to be read in scriptures is written in black. But any comment the person, the man himself, has to make, anything the writer has to make himself, which is not divinely inspired, it is not the medju netcher, the divine words, that's written in red. That's rubric. That's the red ink. So these are all in red ink. It came to pass as his own idea. He puts in there to grease things and to introduce another statement of the scripture. So it came to pass. Here's the next line. It came to pass. Same thing. When yin set, when it came to pass. Next line, it came to pass. Next line, it came to pass. Next line, it came to pass. It came seven times on one page. We turn the page and we go, oh, we don't have to go through all this. No, it starts right out again. It came to pass. Here's a long thing in rubrics because here he's making his own conscious. Here, here, and then after it passed again, here, and it passed the... When came finally the time of sowing? It was the other time of plowing. When it came the time of sowing, this is the story of Joseph and his brethren. See, the time of sowing, when and then it came to pass. He puts them both in there. And now, when it came the time of sowing, and now, and behold, then it came to pass. Here it is again, and it came to pass. So you have to put it came to pass. You can't just start a sentence out cold. Just as in Arabic, it would be very bad taste to start out, I saw a dog. You have to say, inna, inna ra'iti kalab, behold, I saw a dog. And so you have to say that. No, inna ra'iti, you can't say it. Inni, and then say the, and say when you need, very, when you need, you can even say that, it's a common. Well, so the we mustn't worry about this. It's actually, this is strong evidence for what we have here. This came to pass business should be here. It's not out of place at all. You'd have to apologize for it. Well, we're going to ask somebody if style is important. What does style do of a writing? Well, of course, it conditions our response. It establishes the mood of the writer. See, the writer trying to fool you, he can't do it. There's a massive and large work by a German writer called Friedrich Blass on the detecting of ancient forgeries, or what the writer was up to. And you can't fool you. Any long document is impossible. There's no such thing, for one thing, as a clever forgery. It doesn't exist. Only if people want to be fooled can they be fooled, but there's no clever forgery. And anyone who forged the Book of Mormon, and here's the rule also is, a historical text is the hardest to form because it's not somebody's idea, and anybody's free to have any ideas he wants, you see. But if he's writing historical texts like Joseph Smith and having written this big books, hand it to the world and say, this actually happened, this is true. These are just not my reflections like science and health of Mary Baker Eddy, or the writings of the Church Fathers, which are commentaries on the scriptures. They're ideas, they argue with each other. Everybody can write commentaries and inspired works and spiritual uplift poetry and all sorts of inspirational literature. You can grind that out by the ream, you know, there's nothing to it. But sit down and write a history and hand it to people and say, this really happened in such a time, in such a place. This happened, and you're invited to expose it or explode it if you can. That's a very dangerous game to play. And the more you add to it, then you add the danger exponentially. The more you add, the more dangerous this becomes. by the square, by the root, you see. You don't just add another detail, because adding these two details together, that makes it doubly hard. Do those things, not just doubly, but four times, do those things really come together, you see, in the picture, and you go on adding, and you have a whole huge book with every aspect of a civilization in it, and you think you can fool somebody with that? No wonder they won't touch the Book of Mormon. Nobody, even the great Edward Meyer, who laid so much emphasis on the criticism of Joseph Smith and the study of Joseph Smith, never read the Book of Mormon. That's a very interesting thing. They won't do it, you see. Of course, you can read it through. We read it through, like going through, say, the Louvre on roller skates or something like that. Well, I say, I've read it through, and that's that. Well, you should read it through. Isn't every problem in every study or grammar or anything like that, you should read the whole thing through first fast. You don't learn it then, but you get an idea of what you're dealing with and what you're up with. It puts things in place and in position. Do read it through, by all means, as fast as you can in one day, if you can. That's the way you do it. And then you can settle down to things, but it's important to do it the first way, that way. You must move fast when you learn things. So this style is very important, because Joseph can't fool us. He may fool us with the history. That's going to be very hard. But the style is just as hard to fool us with, you see. Well, for one thing, it's written in a number of styles. There are a number of books by a number of authors, and they have been copied down and edited by Mormon, Moroni. This is another test, you see. There's the Brother Hilton at Berkeley got together, a group. They called themselves, what was it, the Hilton Group? And they were going to study the Book of Mormon. They were not Mormons. They were Jews and Catholics and everything in it. And they were professors at Berkeley. And they were going to make a statistical study of the Book of Mormon, studying each of the books separately. You can get that report. Now I've got to find out about what the latest thing is on that. But they find out, how can you study a person's style objectively, test it mathematically? If this book was written by Moroni and this book was written by Nephi, they were two very different men. One of the marvels of the Book of Mormon is the delineation of character in a very short space, in a few words. It brings out with vivid clarity these little beautiful vignettes. You know exactly the kind of a person Abinadi was, well, there's a lot about him, or King Noah was. It just has to say a few sentences and you have a vivid picture of the person. And so here we put things together and we find, were these people the style of Moroni? Did he write in the same style that Nephi did, for example? What do you mean by style? Oh, the Book of Ether. What do you mean by style in this case? How can you measure it objectively? Does this sound like? Well, that's important. You get the feeling. The feeling is a very important thing, but there are certain things. Certain person uses certain expressions again and again. He's fond of using, say, particles that a person doesn't use, or he's fond of using conjunctions, a different conjunction, or he may use behold a lot oftener than somebody else uses. Another may prefer it came to pass, and so it goes. There are all sorts of ways in which you give yourself away, if it's long enough, to form a pattern, and the Books of Mormon, fortunately, are long enough, except for the short dismal period after they settled in the New World and had a hard time struggling along with all the short kings and so forth, short books. But you can measure them, and the styles of the Book of Mormon are very distinct. Each book was written by a different person. This makes it very clear, even though they were edited. But the style is important here, and the style is not the form. It's all formulaic. It's all in the follows the same form as we write in English form style, but everybody has his own style. Bach wrote partitas in every form you could imagine, you see. French, Italian, German, canto dances, and so forth. But it was all Bach. It all had his inimitable style. It had the form, the correct form of each of these musical idioms, but it was his style and it was immortal. You see, everything he touched turned to gold, and he had no imitators or anything like that. Well, it happens with other composers too. But what is the main theme? What would we say was the main theme, the main feeling if you were reading the Book of Mormon? What do you feel most when you read it? Why does it move people so much? What is the thing that hits you most with the Book of Mormon? It's what Aristotle calls spoudeiotes. Spoudeiotes. I'm so sorry we don't have the roll, so we can't ask about that. But we'll have to pass it over. Spoudeiotes is usually translated as high seriousness. It's high seriousness. He means to be understood. He wants to be believed. Whoever wrote the Book of Mormon, in every book, has this earnest zeal to get across. I guess if you're giving it a rhetorical form, the seven rhetorical trophies, you'd call this a suasoria, or you could even call it a protreptic. A protreptic is a missionary talk trying to get you to join our church. And a swazoria, as you can see by the words, a swazoria is attempt to persuade somebody. Our persuade is the two types of address, rhetorically, swaz. And protreptic pro means to our side, and treptic, turn over, step over to our side, you see. Great deal of this. Well, it's not so protreptic, but it certainly is a swazoria. He's trying to persuade us to believe in Jesus Christ. And the title page of the Book of Mormon tells us that's its purpose. It wants to persuade us. Wants to persuade you, Gentile, and everybody else to believe in Jesus Christ. It is frankly a sales pitch. It's really after us. But there are sales pitches, you know. And you can easily detect. It's a surprising thing. With all the skill and rhetorical skills we have in public relations and our various skills of journalism and black, all the poker that goes on today, it's almost impossible to fool a person who doesn't want to be fooled. The appearance of great sincerity and so forth, whether a politician or someone else, it doesn't fool you for long. It comes across for what it is. And this is a thing that the Book of Mormon is not going to fool you at all. It certainly couldn't have been written by some old minister, Spalding or anybody else, because it would be the most tremendous blasphemy if it was. Here he's telling you all about Jesus Christ. He's putting words into the mouth of Jesus Christ. He's calling you to believe this. He bears his testimony, and yet he knows it's just a novel. It's just a fake. That's the explanation they still give. Well, somebody wrote it. Colin Brody said Joseph Smith wrote it as a practical joke to fool his family. He said, I've got the damn fool fixed now. Because that's, according to and so this kid goes to all the trouble around this enormous term paper, this vast piece of work, just to fool his family. It's not very convincing. Yet they consider Mrs. Brody the authority on the subject. And she hasn't read it yet. We have her papers up in the review, and her Book of Mormon has a little mark here, a little mark there, and that's it. She hasn't studied it, not at all. Well, it's very obvious in what she writes in it. We won't worry about her. But the style bears the weight of the message here. Now, you notice the Gettysburg Address was sincere. It doesn't fool you. But other speeches we get, Standing Tall, The New Wind, and all this sort of stuff, Morning in America, how far does that fool anybody? It's a very different sort of thing. Now, Matthew Arnold, in his classic work on the translation of Homer, says Homer, and Homer alone, is great for four qualities that he possesses. Homer's four qualities. And no other work possesses them. We're going to ask you which of these the Book of Mormon stands out for. First of all, most outstanding, hardest to imitate, of a sublime writer like Homer, nobody else ever to pull it off, is preeminently rapid. Oh, that's fine. It's preeminently rapid. Now, you don't expect a solemn epic to be rapid and move fast. But it does. He just rushes along, and that's what's unique. Because you get other, Milton, he bumbles along. He moves at a majestic pace, but he is in no hurry. And other writers, it's almost impossible to write a serious work that really rushes along. You have to milk it out. But look at the Book of Mormon. Look at what the speed. Everything happens in the sixth chapter. You say there's nothing else left for the man to write. He's told it all here. Where does he go from there? The poor guy's going to be awfully embarrassed, not a bit of it. The next chapter is just as good, and it keeps going on and on and on, and it rushes like a jet plane. And he never runs out of ideas. At the end, he's going just as strong as at the beginning. Remember, at the beginning, it begins like a tempest with the rush and the roar, fall of Jerusalem, the terrible tensions going on there, but extremely exciting. It goes on all the running around, hiding in the dark, and so forth. And it ends up at Cumorah with the most appalling and most staggering description of people wiping themselves out. It's a horrendous thing. And all in between, there's never a moment's relaxing. It doesn't, including the long sermons and passages taken from the scriptures. So these things are very important. Well, the first is rapidity. And which rarely goes with the next, if it ever, in anybody else, he says, goes with the next, which is he is preeminently noble, lofty. There's your spudiotes. We certainly get that in the Book of Mormon. Preeminently rapid, preeminently noble. He also uses the word lofty. See, on heavenly news, speak heavenly news, and in the secret top of Hina, the Sinai did inspire that prophet of the people. Come to my lecherous muse that in no common flight intends to soar, but reviews things yet unattempted, yet in prose and rhyme. Chiefly thou, Oh, now this is Milton, you see, but it is the lofty stuff, not the faster. Oh, Spirit, that did inspire that prophet with the people, how the first heaven and earth and so forth. Instruct me, for thou knowest, thou from the first was present on the Holy Ghost. And with mighty wings outspread, dove-like sat brooding on the vast abyss and made his pregnant. What in me is low, raised and sustained? What is something that to the height of this great argument I might assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to man? It's stately prose that goes along. It's lofty, all right, but it's not going to move very fast. They're stuck in the garden for about 3,000 lines. They just keep talking to each other, and Adam and Eve keep chatting for several thousand lines. So this is the way it goes. It's not as bad as that. But you notice, again, this is another thing. This is what Professor King, may have known some of you, Arthur Henry King was here, a well-known professor of English from Cambridge, who came over, joined the church, came over here, and I was teaching, I think, in Arizona. Sorry. But he notices the same thing, that in the writings of the scriptures that we have through Joseph Smith, there's a entirely different tone. There's a majesty that you don't find anywhere. Others try to imitate it. Others, the reorganized and so forth, have tried to come out and produce scripture, and they don't do it. It doesn't sound that way. I notice the stately rhythm here. And now it came to pass, notice he uses both the expressions, this is the long one here, and now it came to pass, year hair, and then wen yin, both of them. And now it came to pass that the people of the Nephites did all return to their own lands. Notice that's a sponding. That's very heavy. Beautiful, isn't it? Homer has to end every line with a sponding, summing it up, the two long strokes that have a solemnity about them. Now it came to pass that the people of the Nephites did all return to their own land. And then lighter, in the 26th year, every man with his family, his flocks and his herd, his horses and his cattle, and all things whatsoever did belong to him. Beautifully balanced prose. The only person who can match that beautiful balance of prose would be Gibbon, I suppose. Edward Gibbon, who wrote the History of Rome, last work in five volumes. That some eminent Englishmen have actually memorized by heart. There were Englishmen who... It was once common to memorize the entire Gibbon's History of Rome by heart. Can you imagine that? Five massive volumes. You can do that, you know. There are people, I've had, we had a girl here who had a scholarship to Cairo while she was there. She memorized the Quran. Well, there's some schools in which you're not admitted to a certain honors unless you know the Quran entirely by heart. We don't do that memorizing anymore. We don't carry the books around with us. It might help. But anyway, we have here, the second quality is that it is noble. You have to admit the Book of Mormon, right, it is noble here, the way it moves. And the third is, it is simple and direct in language. Simple and direct, clear, simple, direct. Words, what's the expression the Book of Mormon uses? In words of exceeding plainness. And it is in words of exceeding plainness, so you can't. Simple, let's say simple and direct. In language. Not for trusted books. Simple and direct in language. There's an amazing fact. The studies of Book of Mormon language all begin with the paradoxical fact. Now, Shakespeare uses 34,000 words. He contributed more to the language than any other person by far, through the usages and everything else. We won't go into that. But the Book of Mormon, this is what's phenomenal, uses only 3,000 words. The most basic language, it's called the most basic vocabulary, for all the common languages, the least you can get around with just stumbling and bumbling is 800 words. But 5,000 words is a minimum vocabulary. You're an ignoramus if you don't know more than 5,000. But the Book of Mormon uses only 3,000 words. That amazingly limited vocabulary. It must, therefore, speak with simple directness and plainness, get the ideas over. It doesn't use a particularly sophisticated word to describe a complex situation. It breaks it down and uses a few simple words that makes it very clear what happens. We get that here. Whatsoever things, and all things whatsoever did belong unto them. Well, you could say, and they're supellectula instead of that, but he breaks it down. They brought back all the things that belonged to them after the war, and they got them all together again. And the fourth quality is togetherness is simple and direct in ideas, he says. Matthew Arnold, this is Matthew Arnold's famous preacher. He says, in language and in ideas, in content, in the stories he tells and so forth. We certainly get involved in it. It happens, but these are human events. People speaking to each other, doing things to each other. But he never gets us involved in sophisticated arguments. He never gets us into deep and tricky matters at all. Even when, say, Abinadi is arguing with the priests of Noah, when they try to trick him and so forth, it's very simple and direct in ideas and in content. In language and in content. The content of the story. Anyone can understand. We have children's books of Mormon. There's no reason why you have to put a children's book of Mormon. Least of all these horrid, horrible animated cartoons. Where Nephi, who's able to put on the armor of the mighty Laban, is a little kid about 10 years old. Oh, terrible. But what else about the style here? It does use, actually, what Martin P. Nelson calls the epic technique of taking a breather between lines and the like. Why the archaic language? Of course, people, more letters written, more questions about that almost than anything else. Why the King James language? Why the Dutch one? Well, when missionaries go out and preach the gospel in Germany, what do they use? They use the Luther Bible, of course. Well, do we accept it as inspired? Well, as a matter of fact, better than ours, the translators of the King James depended very heavily on the Luther Bible. You don't realize that. Luther beat him to the punch, and they borrowed lots from Luther. But it's a great translation. And if we have any questions of what we mean, then we can always revert to the original quotes. We don't have an original text of either. The oldest text we have, the Old Testament, is from the 9th century A.D., the El Asher Codex, the Ben Asher Codex. And that's from the 9th century A.D. And we have 8,000 different ancient manuscripts of the New Testament, none of which are exactly alike. You take your choice among them, as far as that goes. So we make our constructions. But the Book of Mormon sticks to language that follows, and so do other Joseph Smiths, so does the Doctrine and Covenants, that follows the King James Bible as long as it serves. But if it has to be corrected, if it has to be a change, it doesn't hesitate to give us the other. But we follow that. Why do we use the King James Bible? Because it's the accepted text of the Christian world. You're not going to preach the gospel without it. What Bible did the apostles use in the New Testament? And what Bible does the Lord quote in the New Testament? He doesn't quote it. Well, he's quoting the Hebrews, it's true. But in the New Testament we have, in our Greek New Testament, it's the Septuagint we quote. Because the Septuagint was the Bible accepted by the Jews, and was translated by Jews, as a matter of fact, by the Jews and accepted widely by the public. You have to use a text that people accept if you're going to prove anything by the scriptures. And so we naturally use the King James because the world will accept it, and it's good, it's great. Sometimes it isn't always perfectly correct, but then we don't always follow it exactly. The Book of Mormon changes it, but it's not. Joseph Smith doesn't hesitate. There are 2,000 differences in the Book of Mormon where it differs. So we have changes and corrections and so forth. You're not going to lead anybody. But it's strange people make a big argument about, oh, he's just copying from the King James Bible. Well, what language do you expect him to use when we're using the common scriptures accepted by our whole society? So we get the style here, and we go on now, and now we come to this tremendous 15th verse here. We got to the 15th verse of 6th Nephi. It tells us remember what happened first. The pattern is very simple. See, it says here that people are prospered, pride and wealth, class distinction is followed. It tells us much more than that, doesn't it? It tells us when they returned and so forth, and everything was lovely and so forth. They actually rehabilitated the robber, and the result of the post-war boom, there had to be a great deal of public works. Lots of rebuilding of roads, rebuilding of cities. So there was lots of work, lots of contracts, lots to be done, and a lot of people getting rich all of a sudden. And so you have great wealth, great post-war wealth, which leads to the usual, the 1920s and so forth, the pride and the boastings. It's really pride. It doesn't look like pride, for example, but there is I mean, being fashionable, say the fashionable yuppie culture and so forth. But the general contempt we have for those not in that particular culture, not in that particular group, the feeling of superiority we have, and the subtle efforts to just to maintain ourselves as superior and so forth, we have that in our society. A person who wants to succeed, he wants it all, I want it all, and I want it now. We get this all over the place. You have to have the science, you have to wear the best clothes, and so forth and so on. And what makes it real pride, of course, is it definitely you are above others. And this is it, you see, you don't realize that we're all in the same boat, we're all a bunch of slobs and looking else. And oh, really, when you come down to it, read the sermon of Hosiah. And he said, I would that you should always keep in remembrance your own nothingness, he said. The greatness and goodness of God and your own nothingness. If you do this, you will always feel to rejoice. You won't be beset by ambitions and frustrations. You really can't fail in that case. If you start out at the bottom of the ladder, you're going to stay there. Your dependence is entirely on the Lord. And if you remember His greatness and goodness, He'll give you anything you want. It's expedient. That's the best part of it. And then remember, and then he says, remember, you're less than the dust. You're nothing at all. Well, I'm no better than you are, he says. Well, that seems like running down the human race and so forth. He's talking in comparative terms, and it is true, of course. We can't do anything. We're absolutely helpless. We come to the end of the line, and what do we have? The good examples of that, of course, people being utterly terrified. The weariest and most loathed earthly life that age, ache, penury, and imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we fear of death. As Shakespeare says, as Claudius says, and that's a long speech. But this, you see, when we're faced with that, we're all paralyzed, we're all as nothing. You see, we can be reduced very quickly. You notice in our nightly TV dramas how quickly the mood and the pride can change utter humility as soon as the gun changes hand. One carries it. The one who holds the gun is utterly contemptuous. The other is just scum, nothing else. But if by accident he should use the gun, the other should get it, then he's the scum, you see, and the other becomes all-powerful, you see, because he has command over life and death. He holds the bow of Nimrod. He can do what he wants, you know. This idea of holding people in contempt, if we have power over them, and immediately the power shifts hands and we do the same sort of thing. He's such an unstable as water, how unreliable we are, and how quickly we can change from one extreme to another. But you see that happen all the time. So we began here, and then you notice it came, this is the way it was, the public works, they got rich, and the ranks according to riches, and left their rough pride, but some were humbled accordingly, and there became a great inequality in the land, insomuch the church began to be woke up. That inequality is important. Let me read you a Sunday paper. I think I have it here. There is a... Well, that's too good to miss. They had, last week was for the new the turning of the year, here it is. They had interviews with half a dozen of the foremost United States historians, and the leader of them, of course, is Henry Steele Commager. And the article, which is a fairly long one, ends with his statement, which is this. They're talking about what the 80s brought us, and so scientists view the past decade as a period of folly and stagnation. And this is the closing statement by Henry Steele Commager. Remember what we just read? There was a great inequality in the land. He says, the 1980s, said Commager, created for the first time a class society in America. I don't think we don't need the Book of Mormon. For the first time, we have a class society. We have that business now. There are permanently poor that don't expect to be anything else, and permanently rich that don't expect to be anything else except riches. So, a great inequality in all that, and that broke up the church. Why should that break up the church? Because, well, again, you read Mosiah's address here. It began to broken up. So that in the 30th year, now remember we began in the 36th year, we weren't even patronizing, we said, how many years is it from 26 to 30? Because that's a staggering figure. In 4 years, the whole thing is going to fall apart now. This can happen. Already in the articles and editorials, you notice, in the paper and so forth, they're starting to talk about the breakup of the present happy situation in the world. It can't last very long because we're too I were too aggressive for one thing. That's one thing, of course, the Book of Mormon emphasizes all the time. If the people of the Promised Land are destroyed, it will be themselves that do it. The Lord tells Nephi right at the beginning, right in the second chapter, says, I will always cause the Lamanites to be on your neck and breathe down your neck, to keep you in remembrance, to stir you up to remembrance. And as long as you follow my commands, you have nothing to fear from them, he says. That's what it's for. And that's the purpose. But if you misbehave, I'm keeping you there as a scourge, he said, to scourge you when you slip, and they'll be there for that purpose. And I'm going to keep them there. You'll never be able to get rid of them. They'll always be on your necks to remind you what you should do. And if you're ever destroyed, it's because you bring them down on your shoulders. Not they. We have nothing to fear from them. Of course, all our emphasis is on protecting ourselves from those baddies. So in only 4 years, just a few Lamanites were true to the faith. What do you think of that? They were firm and steadfast, diligent to keep the commandments of the Lord. Something the people were not doing very obviously. Of course, it was the law of consecration. And now he's going to tell us, he's going to explain to us. Now, what, after staggering us in that 14th verse by saying, look, only 4 years in this happened, how can that be a natural question? So here's the answer. The cause of this inequality was this. Satan had great power stirring up the people to do all manner of iniquity. Now we come to the character in the Book of Mormon known as Satan, and is he real? This becomes a very real issue too. To do all manner of iniquity, to puffing them up with pride, tempting them to see for these footnotes. Pride comes first, and then comes the four things. If we turn to the last chapter of Nephi, he ends up with these same four things, warning the people against it. Nephi 22, it's 22-23, it's here, I think. Here we are, 22-23, there. Yeah. The lust of the flesh, yes, see, for all those who are built to get gain, and those who are built up to get power, power and gain, they go together, that's our object. That's the 23rd verse of the 22nd chapter of 1 Nephi. It's the last chapter of 1 Nephi, right toward the end of the chapter. The final warning is, builds up to get talking about churches or any societies here. The greatest abomination is this composite, you see, of gain, of power, and to become popular. Again, you must become popular if you're going to stay in power. And this is it. Now we have the techniques of the TV and so forth. You notice the gain and the power, especially TV, has locked these four together very closely. They don't ask you, politicians don't ask you to go out and work for them anymore. They just ask for money to buy TV time. That will win the election. 85% of the elections were won the last time by those who put the most money in it. Well, all the churches to get gain and power and popularity, and what do you do? What's the final payoff? What's the only final lust of the flesh? The glitz, the high living, the rich, all that sort of stuff. Those are the four things. And these are the things that absolutely dominate, you notice, in our prime time TV, which I return time and again. The gain, you gotta get the money. The money's behind all this. The drugs, the sex, the perversion, pornography, the corruption, could, whatever it is, it's money behind it, government or elsewhere. Because you're there after power, and you must become popular. It's not only nice to be popular, but your power depends on it. And the lust of the flesh, which are the payoff. And it says the same thing in this 15th verse of the 6th chapter that we're looking at now. The cause of the iniquity of the people was this. Satan had great power. He has the power to stir up the people to all manner of iniquity, to puffing them up with pride, tempting them to seek for power and authority and riches. That's your popularity. Power and authority and riches and the vain things of the world. That's the fun stuff. That's the high living. Tahita, wherever it may be. And so, thus Satan did stir up the people to do all manner of iniquity. In but a few years, you notice the chronicler himself marvels at it. It should take so few years for all this to happen. What will the world be like 4 years from now? Could anybody even venture a guess? Could you even guess for a moment what it would be like? It would be wild if you dare to do such a thing. But I don't worry at all whether I'm alive or not. I'm saying whether I'm around or not at that time. We have plenty of things to do elsewhere. And they were carried about by the temptations of the devil. He
to carry them whithersoever he desired. Notice here is the me first and I want it all. They're carried out by the temptation, whether he desired to get. Now, what is there, Satan? This is it. Some people don't think there's any Satan. What do we have here? What is the solution here? Go down here. Can we think of any other explanation of evil? We have here, you see, in the Book of Mormon, we have this tug of war. Do we have to assume the existence of Satan? Don't we have enough evil in our natures to get along without having to be tempted by an outside character, some particularly fiendish person? Then, Mosiah tells us about this tug of war here. I'm going to turn to Mosiah 3:19. You don't have to. And he's giving his speech, and we're up against somebody, and he says, behold, oh, he's talking about the real king. You have to find the real king and so forth. But pride takes the lead of the seven deadly sins, but is Satan necessary? That's what I'm wondering about. Today there must be something like that. So when you consider what's happening in Mumbai today, there's a group of terrorists. Nobody knows where they're financed from or something. They get weapons all that. And they're absolutely out to destroy everything they come upon. They just destroy it, and that's all. They have nothing to gain by it or anything else. It's an utter horror. In Mombazik, a country the size of wealthy California, would be a marvelous place, but they can't farm or do anything in it because these terrorists are. Well, the same thing you get with the with certain Indians in the early days, in Southwest Indians, of course. Luke says the one horn and the two horns society. The one horn is very, very dangerous. Don't let them ever catch you out. They're just out to kill. It's such an amazing thing. You should find them. This sort of thing. Bloodshed. You're going to get lots of delighting in bloodshed in the Book of Mormon. But here, this is Satan business. For one thing, it's inseparable. This pride that starts out everything out is inseparable from our existence, is it from our ego. You have to have some pride. You have to have something to hold you up. You have to assert your individuality and being distinct from anybody else. You have to do that or you will wither. But the question is, how far should you go? How far should you assert your own ego and so on? In the 19th century, we went into a carnival of that, which led to Hitler, of course. We're thinking of Nietzsche, naturally, the Superman. Nietzsche introduced the Superman. Then Superman became the fascination of everybody. You get the super science. Superman is still with us. We get Superman. George Bernard Shaw wrote a series of play Man and Superman. He thought the man could become Superman, and certain people thought they were absolutely Superman. So you have the super scientists and so forth. And the first German romance was Holofernes, a drama about Judith. Judith was the name of the drama, of course. Not her, it was Judith. Judith, I'll think of it in a minute. But Judith is the character of the play, and Holofernes is the hero. One of these is the Superman that has to experience everything. This obsession with the Superman absolutely took people over in the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. I grew up in that. We heard the Superman business all the time. Well, Holofernes is burning some poor character on the coals. He is the Assyrian Lord, the commander, and so forth. And the man who's being cooked says, ha, Holofernes, do I see this too? Oh, Holofernes, you don't have this experience. This is one experience you haven't had. So immediately, Holofernes has to go down and lie down beside him. He can't have this person say he has anything Holofernes hasn't got. So he cooks himself, because he can't stand the idea that somebody should have an experience that he hasn't had and should taunt him with it. Well, this is the Superman. We're obsessed with that. As I say, remember what we said when Zola, consider your own nothingness and the goodness of God. So, good and evil are not imaginary situations. They shouldn't be, but they aren't. You notice, it really is evil here. I have something here. Is it here? I just put it out. Not like this one. Well, I bet she's gone. The little things stick around, I notice they're here. And this is a good one. It's rather terrifying. Come on, cutie. Ah, here we are. No. Oh, this is an interesting thing. So what can go on in the world? No, how would you explain a phenomenon like this? This is Lebanon. You know, Lebanon is all being absolutely chewed up. There's going to be nothing left of Lebanon. And, I'll find that to me. One of these days. While shells slammed into Beirut Saturday night, The moneyed elite of the Fakrak, that Fak means pleasure, Fakrak, an hour's drive from the burning city, just an hour away, dined and danced the night away to the strains of whatever will be, Ether after Rockford. They're like people from another planet, say one West Beirut resident, who suffered months of artillery. Now all the town is being destroyed, and a few miles away, these people are living in luxury and spending with plenty of everything and going on. It's an amazing thing. Catan feels the club proves a point, that Lebanon must prevail, however bad is the situation on the streets of the battered capital and so forth. The Fakra Club is a chalet development, just like a fashionable Florida development here, right in Beirut, a few miles from Beirut. A chalet development, it boasts three restaurants, two bars, a swimming pool, tennis courts, and a squash club. So we have Park City within a short drive of Lebanon, which is being destroyed. The capital, which is a whole country, is a very tiny country, as you know, is being wiped out, and yet these people go around living like that. Well, what a weird world. It's something like a drama by Offenbach, isn't it? It's like 18th century Venice. It's weird. It's ghostly that these things could happen. So we have these things here. We go on here in the, back to our sixth chapter. We have it's going to do some explaining here. Satan did lead away the hearts of the people, therefore they enjoyed peace but a few years. In this 30th year, they were carried about by the temptations of the devil where he desired to carry. And you have to give him that power, though, as far as that goes. They were like helpless automatons, you see. This condition is achieved also through the art of rhetoric, salesmanship, and the ancients were susceptible to it, and they're in a state, notice, 4 years later, in a state of awful wickedness. They didn't sin ignorantly. You know. They weren't helpless pawns of Satan. Satan has no power. It's going to tell us but the power that we give him. And that's what all this false representation, misrepresentation, false advertising, and so on, is to lead us astray, to make us willing to follow and so forth. The objectors, and they did it willfully rebel against God. I just, those who happen to stumble upon a passage by Heilbronner here, who was a foremost American. No, this is another one. This is a book from way back. This is W.H. White's book on the organization layer. Well, we won't read that. It's what's happening at the managerial level. But that's not the one. They didn't sin, but they willfully rebelled. Right. It was in the days of Laconius. Thus they begin, and now comes the other thing. If Satan is there, here's Laconius again. Laconius, that Greek name, so he is the governor and the like, who points out the extremely complex nature of race, of ethnology in the Book of Mormon. Many of the people are exceeding angry, and Jesus said, well, then comes to be a reaction. The Lord has to do something. Is he going to do this in our day? There began to be men inspired from heaven. But if the Lord wants to inspire someone from heaven, what can you do about it? This is happening. I think there are such men coming now. My wife is quite active in Yugoslavia, but goes on there in mission and so forth. And this, our last Saturday, we had a visit by this eminent architect from Yugoslavia who works there. In fact, my son-in-law's father is a very eminent architect in Yugoslavia, an antiquarian Roman. He's restored the badge of the Diocletian in Spalato and Split. It's another thing. But these people are aware that strange things are happening. Strange people are suddenly appearing that are not to be persuaded or dissuaded. They suddenly decided to do the right thing, regardless of what it may cost. Because we've never seen a phenomenon like this. Suddenly people decide to do good. And whether it pays off or not. It says that people, again, this is the answer. See, what can you do in a desperate position like ours that began to be men inspired from heaven? So let's look out about it. And when Brother Benson tells us to read the Book of Mormon, to look out for pride as number one and number two issues, he is being inspired from heaven, I believe. Well, I'll try to get the roll the next time and mark people down.